It's time for Security Now. Steve Gibson is here. We've got lots to talk about, some fascinating facts about cryptocurrency, a little more about Spectre and Meltdown, and we'll continue to find a name. We're looking for, anyway, I don't know if we'll find it, for the Spectre and Meltdown flaws in Intel. It's all coming up next on Security Now.
Netcasts you love.
From people you trust.
This is TWiT.
Bandwidth for Security Now is provided by CacheFly at CacheFly.com. This is Security Now with Steve Gibson, episode 650, recorded Tuesday, February 13th, 2018. Cryptocurrency antics. Security Now is brought to you by Thinkst Canary. Detect attackers or malicious insiders on your network with honeypots that can be deployed in minutes. For 10% off and a 60-day money-back guarantee, go to canary.tools/twit and use the code TWIT in the How Did You Hear About Us box. And by Command Line Heroes, a new podcast from Red Hat. Listen to the epic true tales of the developers, programmers, hackers, geeks, and open source rebels revolutionizing the technology landscape. Subscribe wherever you get your podcasts at www.redhat.com/heroes today. And by ZipRecruiter. Looking for your next great hire? ZipRecruiter offers simple tools and powerful matching technology to find you qualified candidates efficiently and effectively. It's the smartest way to hire. Try it free at ziprecruiter.com/security now. It's time for Security Now, the show where we cover the latest security news, help you protect yourself, help you really deeply understand how computers and technology work. And that's all thanks to our explainer in chief, Mr. Steve Gibson. Hello, Steve.
Leo, great to be with you again for the, I don't know why this number hits me. I mean, like 666, that would be a good one too. But this one is 650. I guess just the roundness.
I know why. Because Bill Gates famously said no one would ever need more than 640 Security Nows.
That's
right?
640K.
That's
right.
Yeah.
640. No, nobody needs more than that.
Nobody would ever need more than that.
As I was pulling things together this week, there were a surprising number of interesting stories that involved cryptocurrency in one way or another. We've, you know, I mean, it's been a topic for us because, as we know, you know, dating from our first description of how the Bitcoin blockchain works, then sort of cryptocurrency went silent for a long time. And recently it's just like it's everybody's talking about it. My mother is asking whether I should have her or, well, once asked, not she's not asking any longer, a friend of hers was wondering if she should invest in Bitcoin, and Mom called up and said, "Honey, do you know what a Bitcoin is?"
It's so funny. Yeah. My dad sent me an email saying, "I'd like to find out more about this blockchain thing."
Yeah. So there's like some bizarre, fun stories that involve cryptocurrency. And so as I was putting everything together, I realized, okay, you know, there wasn't any single big news event, which we normally put at the end and that acquires the title of the podcast. So this one is cryptocurrency antics. And we have five interesting sort of antics that we'll talk about as we wrap up the podcast. But lots of other interesting news, I think. We've got what turns out to be sort of a preempted second Tuesday of the month, because this is it. This is one of those months where, and we always sort of note them, where the first of the month is Wednesday, which means that this is the latest, that the second Tuesday is as late as it can possibly fall on, which is the 13th, interestingly, in the month, which is normally the big patch time. But as we mentioned last week when we talked about Woody's enumeration of the fact that 15 out of the 30 days or 31 days in January had updates in them. So anyway, so we've got the preempted second Tuesday of the month. So tracking the slow progress on Intel's Spectre firmware update front, a worse than originally thought Cisco firewall appliance vulnerability. I knew about this last week, but it looked like the conditions where it would be a problem were restricted, and it didn't really affect end users. It was an enterprise problem. Well, since then, it sort of exploded. So I thought, okay, we got to talk about that. Also, MIT Technologies Journal introduced this notion of an unsuspected threat from hovering hacking drones. And I thought, well, okay, that's not kind of fun. We also have hacking at the Winter Olympics to talk about, Kaspersky's continuing unhappiness, and the historic leak of Apple's iOS boot source code,
which I was hoping you'd talk about that. Yeah.
Yeah, I got to talk about it. And what I love about this story is how it's the classic way that this sort of happens, where it wasn't malicious, but it was inevitable. So it's sort of fun. Also, there's a critical Wi-Fi update for some Lenovo laptop users, a glitch at WordPress that's a sponsor. And so it's sort of an interesting automatic update thing that I wanted to make our listeners aware of. Then we have a little bit of miscellany. Oh, and I have to have you play, because I think we're going to have time, an interesting rap on passwords. Don't know if you saw it, but if you want to scroll down while I'm doing some of this
I'll
take a look at it.
It is
SFW, meaning it is safe for work.
Okay.
But it's really just cute. It's a few minutes long. It's posted over on Facebook, and the link is here in the show notes under miscellany. Then we'll close the loop with some of our listeners. Most of the feedback was people suggesting names in response to my musing last week that it was annoying to have to say Meltdown Inspector, Inspector and Meltdown, and we really need a concatenation somehow. So we've got every possible variation that you can imagine that our listeners have provided. And then we're going to take a look at some cryptocurrency antics, including finishing up with one that you just makes you do a face plant. It's just it's too amazing. So I think a great podcast for
and
it.
I have an image of the week to join your image of the week.
Oh, yay.
Yeah,
cool.
I sent it to you, but maybe you didn't see the email. I know you don't like to look at email.
Actually, I saw it, but I didn't click on the link or I didn't find the image, but I had seen what you were referring to, so
yeah.
I'm glad you'll be able to provide it.
We had mentioned it last week, and the guy the guy who actually created it or knew the guy who was created in his office sent us more information about it. So
yep.
I will pull that up as well. But we are going to welcome a brand new sponsor to the show. Actually, an old sponsor coming back, but somebody we've talked about before. In fact, on the show, we talked about Canary Tokens. And Canary is a device, a hardware device, as well as a software tokens from a company called Thinkst, Thinkst. And I'm really happy to have them on the show because I think this is an absolutely stellar product for anybody that wants to secure their systems, secure their networks, and so forth. Let me kind of give you some background. All we have to do is think back to the Sony Pictures Entertainment hack and the fact that we learned that the hack started with, it was a spear phishing. They think a spear phishing email to members of the company that got the guy in or guys in. And then for months, unbeknownst to anybody at Sony or any of the IT people or the security people, they were wandering around the network looking for assets, looking for ways to get those assets. They had the whole network fully surveyed for months before they actually did anything. And if Sony had, instead of just burying their head in the sand, bought a couple of canaries, this wouldn't have been a problem. The canary is not something that looks vulnerable on your network. The canary is something that looks valuable on your network. Actually, let me go to the canary interface. You connect it to your network, you plug it in, and you can control it, and you can make it look like anything at all. So I'm going to pull up the canary interface real quickly. I logged into it right before the show. Two-factor,
of course. It's a honeypot.
It's a honeypot. Thank you for helping me with that. Oh, wait a minute. I have an alert. Unattended alerts on my canary. 2 weeks alerts. Oh, here we go. Let's see. It's a login attempt. 9 times somebody tried to get in. Here's the login attempt. First, they used the username Leo and password Laporte, then Bob Hoskins. What? This was Patrick Norton trying a bunch of things. He was trying to get into my guy Canary. The Canary is, in this case, configured as a Synology disk station named Backup NAS. But you can configure it as all sorts of things. You can choose any kind of device that you think would be attractive. I not only configured it as a NAS, but I put file transfer protocol, just not even secure, just regular FTP. I put a web server on it, all sorts of stuff. The Canary will also allow me to generate Canary tokens, which could look like a PDF or a Microsoft Word document that I could put anywhere. If somebody hits it, I will get an alert immediately. They won't get a document. So I'm not going to say what I have on here, but I might happen to have, say, a spreadsheet that says payroll information stored.
Or a Bitcoin wallet.
I do have that. Or Bitcoin wallet. And people, when they hit it, I will get alerts. The other thing is they dedupe alerts. So you don't get hundreds of alerts from your Canary. You get one high-quality alert. You saw what I got that said there were 9 login attempts. So I immediately could look at them all. So I didn't get spammed with alerts. Just one high-quality alert when it matters. This is the easiest honeypot ever. Zero administration overhead. Within minutes of your configuration, your Canary can look like anything from a router to a switch, a NAS server. You can make it a Linux box. You can make it a Windows server. There are dozens of things you can configure it as, which is really fun. Let's see. Commission a new Canary. It's really easy to add new Canaries. You don't pay, by the way, all up front. They make it affordable. You basically license it. In fact, if anything happens, if somebody sits on it or you pour coffee into it, they'll just send you a new one because it's part of your service agreement. These guys have been in the game for 2 decades. They've trained companies. They've trained the military and governments. I can't tell you who they worked for, but I could tell you if you knew who they worked for, you would go, oh, yeah, these guys know what they're doing. It's really, really a powerful system that's easy to use, very well priced, and in fact, so well that you could try a few and scale up as you want. Some small companies have a couple of Canaries. There are banks with Canaries everywhere, hundreds of them, all over their network. They're deployed literally on all 7 continents. Now, if you think about that, that means they're also in Antarctica. I can't say who, but yes, some of the biggest names in Silicon Valley run them. In fact, the security guy at Slack said the Canary is like one of the 2 security devices you need in your life. You're going to love it. You can find out more, canary.tools/twit. See them in action. $7,500 per year, and you get 5 Canaries for that. So you could put them all over the place. You get your own hosted console, upgrade, support, and maintenance for a full year, just $7,500. And, you know, the Canary tokens are free, but they come from the Thinks servers. And so a savvy attacker might look and block traffic or note traffic to the Thinks servers. By getting your own Canary, you can generate as many Canary tokens as you need, and they all go to address within your network, just as you might expect. So they are completely, you know, untraceable, and they look like what they say they are, whether it's a PDF or a Word document. So get a few Canaries, spread the tokens all around. Never again will somebody wander your network for months undetected. You'll know the minute they go in there. By the way, did I say $7,500? We got a special deal for the audience. When you use the offer code TWIT, not Security Now, but just TWIT generically in the How Did You Hear About Us box, 10% off, not just for the first year, but forever. We know you're going to love your Thinks Canary, but of course, if you're not happy, you can return your Canaries within their 2-month money-back guarantee for a full refund. So there's no reason, if you run a network and you would like a honeypot, look at that. It doesn't even look like something, you know, scary. Looks like a Roku or something. Put one on top of your TV. The guys will never even look at it. Canary. Go to canary.tools/twit and use twit in the How Did You Hear About Us box. That's canary.tools/twit. I love this thing. I'm happy to have one. Most people who have them don't tell people they have one.
Yes, that you're not supposed to mention that.
You know that NAS server in Leah's office? Go ahead, try to log in. Just go ahead. Just see what happens. I love it.
Yeah, you know that extra Roku he has sitting on top of
his... Yeah, not what it appears to be.
Yeah, not so much.
I should actually
Well, and that
you.
Also fits. That also fits what we're coming to understand as the necessary model for security.
Yes.
And that is, it's no longer enough to be passive.
Right.
It's necessary to actively participate in the security of your network. That means an intrusion detection system like this is, really looking, monitoring your traffic and seeing what's going on, which this does. And, not just saying, my firewall has its ports closed. It's like, that's not enough anymore because stuff gets in. And the sooner you, as you mentioned in the Sony example, the sooner you're aware that something is, making queries at your printer for like from inside the network. It's like, wait, what? What's doing that?
See, and this, so, I'm creating a new Amazon's fake Amazon bucket. Oh, I'm going to put all sorts of good stuff in here. It's actually kind of fun to play with. Yeah, it's – well, what is it we always say? Good security is layered. And you want a variety of different ways to protect yourself. And this, I think, is a great active way to keep an eye on your network. Yeah, we're really happy to have them as your – it's your own private honeypot. Exactly right.
Well, and I would say, again, the difference is active instead of being passive because you could have passive layers and that's good. But increasingly we're seeing it's necessary to be proactive in order to really understand, in order to be able to confidently say nothing is going on here. You have to have some basis for that. So
they have canaries in the cloud, too. You can run a canary in your EC2, for instance. All right.
So our picture of the week ties into the second thing we're going to talk about at the top of the show. And this is just another fun, people are having a lot of fun with the Intel logos, and we've been having fun with them during the various, all year so far since this whole Meltdown and Spectre nightmare. And so this is just, it's the Spectre Inside logo that we talked about last week. This time there's a little circumflex and it says still inside. Spectre still inside. And that is the case. In fact, I'll just jump over and we'll talk about the second Tuesday in a second. I went looking for the podcast for the latest news from Intel, and it's rather quiet. The only thing I could find was another press release written in the first person. I'm always a little jarred by this when Navin Shenoy at Intel writes in the first person. But on February 7th, he posted security issue update. Progress continues on firmware updates, which, that's good. They haven't given up. So, we don't want them to give up. Anyway, so now Navin said, Intel continues to work closely with industry partners to protect customers against the security exploits disclosed by Google Project Zero. As I shared, which is always the part that jars me a little bit, January 22nd, we identified the root cause of the reboot issue affecting the initial – and remember, this is the guy who was saying they were rebooting more often than usual. Like, what? Oh, anyway, at all would be bad, affecting the initial Broadwell and Haswell microcode updates. Since then, we've been focused on developing and validating updated microcode solutions for those and other impacted platforms. And then he said, earlier this week, we released production, and this is news, production microcode updates for several Skylake-based platforms to our OEM customers and industry partners, and we expect to do the same for more platforms in coming days. We also continue to release beta microcode updates so that customers and partners have the opportunity to conduct extensive testing before we move them into production. So last week, Skylake mobile and desktop firmware was released. So as we remember from this debacle, the first microcode update attempted to add instruction set features to give operating systems control over branch prediction, which is this aspect of the speculative execution and branch prediction, which was what Spectre was able to leverage. Those first firmware updates were releases for Broadwell, Haswell, Skylake, Kaby Lake, and Coffee Lake processors, but we quickly learned that Broadwell and Haswell systems were having trouble, and then we later determined that all of them were, Skylake, Kaby Lake, and Coffee Lake also. So that shut down all of this firmware. It all got pulled back. In some cases, new BIOSes were made available to put the old firmware back. We know that Microsoft ended up producing an official patch, which wasn't pushed, that their customers could go and get to set the bits in the registry to disable their use of these new firmware instructions. And, you know, and as I mentioned last week, it turns out that the same bits that the GRC's little inspector app sets, and if you want to deliberately disable the mitigations for these. So at this point, the latest news I have been able to find is that last week Intel did release firmware for Skylake, but for no other major processor families. So the expectation is that those who have Skylake-based systems may shortly, after the OEMs verify probably more carefully than they did last time, that the firmware is not causing trouble, may be able to get firmware updates. So that's where we are. This is taking a while. And again, I'm impressed that Intel can do something this significant with firmware. You know, as I explained a couple weeks ago, firmware in a microprocessor is not like software on application level software, where you can write word processors, you can write graphics programs, you can write image compressors. I mean, you can do anything because it's meant to be a general purpose instruction set that the software runs. Firmware that, you know, microcode firmware is not a general purpose instruction set. It's a way of simplifying an incredibly complex hardware design by moving some of it into a masked ROM, which allows some sequencing to manage the flow of data through pathways in the chip. And it's easier to do it with some data patterns. And what Intel provides is the ability to override that built-in ROM with microcode patch. But the idea of coming along after the fact and allowing and arranging firmware to have control over something you never intended it to control. I mean, this is a major design revision to the processors. And so I'm impressed that they can do it at all. I mean, they haven't done it yet, apparently. So I guess they have on Skylake. But it is an intensely architecture-dependent thing. It's possible, and I'm not predicting this, and I'm way on the outside, so I have no inside knowledge, but I wouldn't be surprised if they said, we can't fix this on this or that processor. That is, we can't fix it in firmware. The firmware doesn't have the flexibility. That wouldn't surprise me. I would say, okay, well, that's entirely reasonable for that to be true. So it's going to be interesting to see how this progresses. You know, the last thing Intel wants to say is a fundamental problem has been discovered in our chips that we can't fix. You know, but the idea that these chips are even fixable is something we sort of take for granted. But They may not be. So it's going to be interesting to see how this plays out over time. At this point, Skylake, they've released the firmware for that, and we'll be waiting for firmware for the others. And I mentioned that the second Tuesday of the month is today, and that as a consequence of the crazy startup that we've had this year, we got the February security roll-up update for our systems last Tuesday, the 6th. And it wasn't clear to me because we've had so many of them. I mean, it's been a week, which is, you know, longer than we went all through January. But okay, I fired up my machine and looked for updates and nothing came. So it looks to me like the only thing we are getting today was what Microsoft did push, which was an update for the Adobe Flash 0 day, which we discussed last week. And so there, that was made available today, but it looks like Microsoft is going to sit tight with the major roll-up that we received for February last week. So a week ahead of schedule, ahead of their normal schedule. I mentioned also Cisco's problem. Late January, so a couple of weeks ago, the news hit that there had been responsible disclosure to Cisco from a Cedric Halbron with the NCC group that they had discovered a very worrisome vulnerability in a family of Cisco enterprise class, you know, like kind of big iron firewalls. They're collectively known as Adaptive Security Appliances, ASA is the acronym. And at the time, it was initially believed that only the VPN component of those ASA devices, and there's a family of them, but the initial list was like maybe 5 or 6 of them of a much greater number were vulnerable, and that it only affected some configurations. And I remember thinking, okay, well, this doesn't really impact our listeners directly. It's not like, you know, consumer routers or something. Well, since then, several things happened. The number of affected devices has more than doubled, and the list of subsystems, the subsystem components, have went from 1, meaning the VPN, to 11. So all kinds of things in there are vulnerable. And it has now become attacked in public. We're now we're now seeing hackers actively exploiting the vulnerability in these devices. And there is something on the order of 200,000 of them publicly exposed. These are inherently internet-facing firewall appliances from Cisco. So, you know, their job is to be out there on the front line, keep people from getting into your network. Unfortunately, it itself is vulnerable. And this has got a exploitation score of 10 out of 10. So it's critical severity. And the 10 out of 10, in order to get 10 out of 10, it has to be essentially, you know, as bad as it can get. It's easy to exploit, so it has a low level of attack code complexity. It can be exploited remotely and requires no authentication on the device. So the good news is this was disclosed responsibly. Cisco made the patches available. On the other hand, as we know, from all the machines that are, you know, all the Windows machines, for example, servers that are still unpatched, as we were talking about last week, months and months after important vulnerabilities have been made available, anybody running in an enterprise environment that has one of these adaptive security appliances needs to make sure that they're current. to their current patch level, because it is now not just a known problem, but it is actively being exploited in the wild. MIT's Technology Review had an interesting story about cyber warfare taking to the skies aboard drones. And when I encountered that, I thought, what? I think I remember some time ago we were having fun with the idea of a drone that had some sort of a projectile launcher on it, and we were joking that if the projectile was too heavy, the drone would get pushed backwards when it tried, you know, from recoil when it tried to launch this. In this case, these are radio relay drones, and it turns out they exist in actuality. It is a new mode of attack. The idea being that there are some instances where people improperly believe that if they've got unsecure radio, they are safe from attack. That is just due to the fact that, oh, well, the range isn't that great. A perfect example was a demo that was given at one of the hacking conferences recently, where one of these hacking drones was flown outside of a building and was able to pick up the radio signal of a wireless mouse. And although, you know, you'd have to watch the signal and do a lot of reverse engineering in order to figure out what was going on, you could certainly from that get position and clicks. And potentially that's an information leakage. It doesn't seem that, you know, that worrisome to me, but this is, of course, as we know, this is always the way these things start. So,
and a wireless keyboard would be more informational.
Exactly. And we know that, as we had talked about, some of the early ones would just use pathetic encryption. I mean, you can't even call it encryption.
Or something, yeah.
In fact, they're putting out 8-bit ASCII, and they came up with a random 8-bit mask which just XORed the bits.
But they do use the same mask for every keyboard.
Yeah,
right?
Yeah. As soon as you put the battery in, it like sets this XOR mask, and it's like, okay, wait. I mean, in fact, that would be a nice final exam question for, you know, CS 101 or an introduction to computer security. Is here's a stream of text which is from a wireless keyboard with a static 8-bit XOR, what was being typed? Because, you know, frequency analysis immediately, you know, collapses this encoding. And as soon as you – and the interesting thing about this, I mean, how bad that is as soon as you identify, like, what the T or the S or the E is, as soon as you can figure out one character –
right.
Then you immediately know what the mask is,
right.
And the entire thing collapses.
It's a convenient thing about XOR. Yeah, it goes both ways.
Yes, exactly. And in fact, and so your example, Leo, is perfect. So, so what is being done is that there are now experiments being conducted with drones being used to move essentially a spy outpost into an unsuspected location. So it's easy for people to you know, think, oh, well, we're out in the middle of nowhere. We don't have to worry about, you know, securing our Wi-Fi or using a secure phone communications and so forth. Well, just worth planting the seed that lack of proximity to radio is no longer any true security, and that like spy drones sucking in radio are becoming a thing. Yikes. The Winter Olympics, as we know, are underway as we're doing the podcast, and so is Olympic hacking. There haven't been any clear stories yet to surface from this, except that it is the case that tensions were expected to be lower with North Korea because they're part of the Olympics now, and so there, you know, there's not the heightened problems with diplomatic relations. On the other hand, Russian athletes were banned from participation, and so it was expected and has turned out that Russia's hacking efforts were running full bore, and that there were multiple nations' security teams who were in place for months beforehand and have been fending off and observing attacks against the Olympic network's infrastructure have been going on like for months beforehand. Systems were being probed, and it's looking more like they're trying to create embarrassment than, you know, like of individuals or the actual operating of the system in real time. So no huge events from that. We'll have to see. Maybe, you know, a couple of weeks from now we'll have more information. But it is an obvious target for attackers, and they're not missing the opportunity. Also yesterday, Kaspersky Lab filed another lawsuit against the U.S. We talked about Kaspersky's unhappiness with the U.S.'s decision late last year to back away from the use of, and in fact, to forbid the use of their antivirus tools over concern that there was some Russian state government influence over what was going on. We talked about the news that apparently it was as a consequence, which seemed inadvertent and may well have been inadvertent, of the Kaspersky's AV picking up some code samples and phoning home with them, that was a way that there had been some exfiltration of confidential data from systems that were being protected by Kaspersky's AV. So this lawsuit filed just yesterday is related to this ban on the U.S. use of Kaspersky's products. That was part of the 2018 National Defense Authorization Act that the Trump administration signed into law at the beginning of October. And in the court documents filed yesterday, in the U.S. District Court of D.C., the District of Columbia, Kaspersky is claiming that the ban is unconstitutional. Their lawyers are saying that under the U.S. Constitution's Bill of Attainder Clause, Congress is forbidden from enacting laws which impose individualized deprivations of life, liberty, and property, and inflict punishment on individuals and corporations without judicial trial. So, I understand, and we've talked about, you know, their unhappiness, but it's difficult to forgive our agencies from being, I think, reasonably cautious over this idea. You know, as I've said for quite some time, I'm surprised that Microsoft Windows is as widely deployed globally as it is, because it's a closed system. And I apparently Microsoft does make source code selectively available to some instances to major states where they have, like, you know, they have to show what they're doing in order to get the okay. But, you know, we've moved to a mode now where, as we know, Windows 10 systems no longer have any choice about accepting updates. You know, so Microsoft literally has an institutionalized software implantation system in place today. We have no reason to believe that Microsoft would ever or has ever abused that. And it would be, I think, the last thing that they would do. But the facility is there. So, you know, given that we've got increasingly mature alternatives, open source alternatives, it's just difficult for me to see how anything but inertia is responsible for continuing to use these sorts of systems. So anyway, it'll be interesting to see. I doubt anything will come of this. I think that I'm sure that our governments, our state and local and national governments have a right to choose which software they wish to use. And it is creepy to have antivirus systems installed which maintain a connection back outside of the country, and specifically to Russia, that have the ability to send questionable software back for analysis. That seems like something you want to think twice about. Okay, and the story, Leo, that you wanted to talk about, and I'm glad you were wanting to go into this because I think this is really interesting. Apple had the source of their iOS boot code posted on GitHub last week, and it's not surprisingly called iBoot, which is the code which first runs as the system powers up in order to form the anchor of the chain of trust which brings the whole system online. And we've talked about the way secure boot technologies in general work, and Apple's is no different. That is, you start with some highly trusted code, which is probably in ROM or is, you know, signed, and its signature is verified in a way that cannot be interfered with, intercepted, contravened. You know, there's no way to subvert that. That code comes up, makes sure that it has not been tampered with, and then it goes and loads the next stage in the boot sequence. And similarly, after obtaining it from storage, but before ever executing it, absolutely verifies that it too has had its integrity maintained and is then safe to transfer control to. Control then transfers to it, and it repeats that process, essentially forming a chain of trust where each link is independently verified from the code that's already running prior to turning control over to it. The point is that the entire integrity of the system depends upon the anchor, that original code. And so it is significant that the source for that was posted last week. Now, Apple has sort of downplayed this a little bit. In their statement, they said old source code from 3 years ago appears to have been leaked. But by design, the security of our products, writes Apple, does not depend upon the secrecy of our source code. Well, we know that that's good. There are many layers of hardware and software protections built into our products, they write, and we always encourage customers to update to the newest software releases to benefit from the latest protections, unquote. At the same time, we also know that this kind of core code doesn't change very much. I mean, this was part of iOS 9 back in 2016 when this code leaked. And it's certainly the case that now we're at 11. There may well have been some changes. There may be some, and probably are, some new hardware in the later, some new hardware, security hardware in the later iPhone hardware. So it's probable that the iBoot code was tweaked a bit. At the same time, we also know that a lot of code doesn't change. We're still, Windows users are seeing dialog boxes if you drill down underneath the UI very far back from Windows 2000 that hasn't changed. If you bring up the network adapter details dialog, that's the dialog from Windows 2000. That core code that is done tends not to change. So Apple's understandable sensitivity is not only to the fact of the leak, but to the fact that while their statement suggests correctly that they're not depending upon obscurity, it's also the case that bad guys or phone hackers will be salivating over the idea of having access to this iBoot source, because by attacking the source code from the standpoint of trying to find something that was done wrong, you can just get a lot of ideas, a lot of potential leads for where to attack. So the interesting thing about this from a reality of keeping things private is that an intern, a low-level, what was described as a low-level employee in some of the coverage, and I also saw the term intern used a couple of years ago, had some friends in the phone hacking, in the jailbreaking community, and he was at Intel, he or she, don't know, was at Apple. And the friends were pushing to have this person share this iBoot source and a bunch of other tools as well that this person had access to. So this was a small group of trusted individuals. And I should mention that Motherboard had really good reporting and coverage of this. They interviewed, under promises of anonymity, a lot of these people who had firsthand knowledge of how this happened. So there was a very tight-knit, small group who did friends of this intern who did receive this iBoot source code 2 years ago under the promise that it would not be shared outside their little circle.
I'll give it to you, man, but you gotta swear you don't give us to anybody else.
Exactly.
You gotta swear, pinky swear, man.
And to their credit, I guess, that promise endured for 2 years, but the code existed nevertheless on thumb drives or on hard drives, outside of Apple. And those, some secrets are just too good to keep, they're just too difficult. And so you can imagine that when it was new, when it was fresh, when it had just been received, it was, oh, nobody else has this. This is super cool. And so they had sort of the people outside of Apple had their own proprietary interest in keeping it safe. But those kinds of secrets are hard to keep. And so they wanted to share it. One of them, within this group, they don't today know who leaked it outside of their little group, but presumably someone did. Somebody had a friend and, of course, said, okay, I'm going to share this super cool code with you, but you absolutely have to, double pinky swear that it goes no further. Oh, of course, of course, of course. And of course, who knows? Maybe it was that person. The point is that some secrets are just too hard to keep. And And so through essentially what amounts to social engineering and insider disclosure, this code got out. This wasn't a flaw in a highly academically scrutinized cryptographic cipher, you know, where, you know, oh my God, if, you know, if you number crunch this thing for 12, you know, CPU centuries, then there was a chance that you could find some information leakage. No, this was an intern who was at Apple, who had access to this and didn't, you know, did sign an NDA, of course. There was some mention of that in the motherboard coverage, that the person, of course, I mean, he had to sign a confidentiality agreement in order to be there and to have this kind of access, but that didn't, in fact, prevent it from escaping. So it's not clear that this, I mean, this is not probably devastating. It is true that Apple, the other side of this code being as mature and unchanging as it probably is that it is probably mature. But Apple did immediately use a DMCA takedown order to get this yanked from GitHub. It also was somewhere else. I can't remember where it was removed from. So basically, Apple immediately moved to clean this up. And I imagine there are, you know, Apple has a security team that is probably hot on the trail of how this happened, working to remove as much of this from public access as possible. But it was on GitHub for, you know, like the fact that it was there at all means it disappeared. I mean, it got loose. So it is now out in the jailbreaking, the greater jailbreaking community. Someone whose handle was Zioshiba, Z-I-O-S-H-I-B-A, was the pseudonym of the person who posted this on GitHub. And it was among the people who knew of the original leak. This was, it was identified as a copy, whatever that means. But what we understand it means is that this was a subset of the total leak package. So there was more that was leaked than ended up being posted. So maybe the disclosure from the original small group was less than what all that was posted, or, you know, who knows what path the leak took to get to GitHub. But it was there and it was up for some length of time. It got a lot of attention. And so, you know, I don't have access to it. I have no interest in it, but, you know, I'm not inside that community. And you have to imagine now that there are lots of eyeballs scrutinizing the code, looking to see whether, oh, look, you know, here's an unsafe type conversion where if we're able to get a negative something in here, blah, 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 who knows? At the same time, this is not code that probably interacts with the outside world much. It's not accepting random parameters and things. You know, it's the fact that it is as root as it is means that it is probably not subject to external manipulation. On the other hand, it is knowledge which Apple did not want made available, and it did get out. So,
yeah, I mean, there are a couple interesting conversations that are unknown. You raised one, which is how much is this code modified? Apple says it's old code, but as you point out, why modify iBoot?
Right.
I didn't look at the code, so I don't know how complex it is. Or how hardware dependent it is. This came from iOS. What did they say? It was 2014, so it would have been iOS 9, I think.
Yep.
But the other one is, and obviously it's security through obscurity, and of course you don't want to give it away. But how much damage is done? People, Jonathan Levin, the guy who verified the code, said, "Yeah, well, I've disassembled the iBoot, and it matches my disassembly." So yep. What would you get? You would get symbol names. You get a symbol table that you wouldn't have that with a disassembly. that's about it, right?
When you disassemble, you're inherently making lots of guesses.
Okay.
And so you're doing a lot of reverse engineering. Sometimes stuff happens, like with specific hardware registers,
right,
where bits are being poked and stuff.
Right.
And so
right.
That's like an unknown. But if you've got the names of those, the actual, you know, the actual nomenclature that goes along with that, it's, you know, there's a lot more that you're getting. So, you know, you can really you can look at it both ways. I don't think it's the end of the world by any means. And frankly, I'm surprised this doesn't happen more often.
It has happened once before, I think, right?
Right.
Yeah.
Right. But still, I mean, the idea that a company the size of Apple with as much intellectual property as they have, this is a major event because it's considered an unprecedented leak. That alone is impressive, an impressive statement about Apple's security. I think they're doing a good job overall.
Yeah, yeah. Why the intern had access to the source code is another question. But
you can imagine there'll be some internal surveilling of
their processes. They didn't care that much. You know, like saying, yeah, well, fine. If it gets out, it gets out.
Yeah, it could be.
Yeah.
And Leo, I'm going to take a sip of coffee.
Well, I think you should, Steve, because I am going to do a commercial. It's an amazing coincidence.
Our timing is just, you know, you think we'd done this before.
That coffee is good. Our show today brought to you by Command Line Heroes. I love Red Hat. I think the first Linux I ever installed live on television on the screensavers was Red Hat. It's certainly been around a long time. It's one of the most best known names in open source software, best known Linux distribution. It's the source of some of the most robust, solid distributions of all. And it's fair that they, as huge supporters of open source, would do a podcast called Command Line Heroes, dedicating to telling the epic true tales of developers, programmers, hackers, geeks, and open source rebels who are revolutionizing the technology landscape. They've got a wonderful host, Saran Yitbarik, and she has got some of the best guests. I'll give you some of the episodes from the first season. The OS Wars of the 80s, back when Linux was not around, but it became the genesis of Linux in the early 90s, covering desktop, the battle for the data center. She does a whole episode on the development of the Agile movement, which is fascinating. People like Kent Beck. The story of DevOps. If you're a DevOps, your story is being told finally. And those doing combat in the cloud. They make it sound exciting, don't it? You might be one of those command line heroes if you've ever taken apart something to see how it works. Every one of you. Or maybe you'd rather make something instead of just using it. Every one of you. Command line heroes. They're the makers, the builders, the dreamers, the doers who are transforming tech and shaping our tomorrows. Red Hat. .com/heroes, redhat.com/heroes, all lowercase. Maybe you don't know Saran, but she founded Code Newbie. She does a couple of other tech podcasts, and she is a huge open source advocate. So it's really a lot of fun. redhat.com/heroes and subscribe wherever you get your podcasts. Or you can go to the website, there's extras there, and you can find out what the episodes are and so forth. redhat.com/heroes. And we're so glad to be able to support Red Hat for all the great stuff that they have done all these years. It's really, I have my Red Hat. I should have put it on. I should put it on. From now on, I'll put it on for the story. All right. Back to the caffeinated Steve Gibson.
Yes, I am. So last September, we covered the news of a big concern in the Broadcom Wi-Fi chipsets.
Yes.
This affected Apple devices and Android devices, all which use these Broadcom chipsets. And our listeners will remember that you didn't have to be associated with a an access point. You didn't have to be connected to Wi-Fi. It just had to be a specially formed packet that your mobile device could receive that allowed it to be taken over. So, you know, everyone ran around and it was important to get patched. And we talked about another example of the necessity of our devices over time being maintained somehow. That this is, it just, the lesson keeps being, the nature of this is that, you know, these are computers and they need to have some sort of an ongoing maintenance facility of some kind. Well, it turns out that there are a subset of Lenovo's ThinkPads also using this Broadcom. It's the BCM4356 is the chip. The wireless LAN driver for Windows 10 is also and similarly vulnerable. The vulnerability is rated 10 out of 10 for exactly the reasons I just enumerated. It's remote, requires no user interaction, and can potentially be used to perform remote code execution attacks. But it does, as was the case with the previous mobile devices, require you to be within radio reception range proximity. So it's, you know, it's not like the North Koreans are going to get you when you're in South Dakota. You're safe. But it does mean that if this were to become prevalent, somebody within radio reception range, somebody in the coffee shop where you are, or on the train or in the airport or wherever, could exploit this driver in a select set of laptops. And those laptops are the ThinkPad 10, the L460, the P50S, the T60, T60P, T460, T460P, T460S, the T560, the X260, and the ThinkPad Yoga 260. Those and only those devices have updated Wi-Fi driver available, and owners of those should go to Lenovo, or, you know, most of our ThinkPads now have a Lenovo, you know, check to make sure you're updated and current and safe option from Lenovo. So either go get it, but if you have a ThinkPad that I just named off there, you know, they've got many, many more. For example, our X1 Carbons are not among those. But I think, I don't know if your Yoga is a 260, Leo.
I have a second generation Yoga, so I'll be checking.
And okay, it's worth...
T470S, was that in there?
No, not in there. Right.
Yeah, because I don't see anything when I run that.
So, you know, they have so many models that this is just a small subset, but it is worth making sure that you've got the latest wireless LAN driver just to be on the safe side, because it's regarded as a 10 out of 10. Again, more likely that you would be targeted for attack. So if your profile is such that you're known to be carrying that laptop, one of those laptops, and you might be a target for attack, definitely want to make sure you're
when you run the Lenovo Vantage software, which is now what they use to update it. It says right on the front, Lenovo Wi-Fi security, protect yourself from malicious Wi-Fi networks. Oh, that's not related, or is it? That's something that you can turn on. That's something else, though. Which I like that lets you kind of, I don't know what they do. It's not a VPN, but they have some sort of thing that they do.
Extra
so
goodie.
The extra goodie. Yeah, so that's not that. So.
Since WordPress is a sponsor, I wanted to let our listeners know that there was a small glitch last week in the release of WordPress version 4.9.3, which last week was the latest. They patched a total of 34 known vulnerabilities, but unfortunately, in the process of installing the updates, the automatic update mechanism itself got broken, which meant that WordPress would no longer be doing automatic updates. So I'm not sure what mechanism they have for notifying their users. You probably get email if you are a registered WordPress user who's receiving this. But the problem is that since 4.9.3 broke the update mechanism, it's necessary for WordPress admins whose systems did grab 4.9.3 to go get 4.9.4 manually, because the system is no longer able to update itself. The lead developer, Dion Hulse, explained. He said that one of these changes aimed to reduce the number of API calls which get made when the auto update cron task is run. He said, unfortunately, due to human error, the final commit didn't have the intended effect and instead triggers a fatal error, as not all of the dependencies of, and then there's a function, find core auto update are met. He said, for whatever reason, the fatal error was not discovered before 4.9.3's release. It was a few hours after the release when discovered. So, again, I salute WordPress for making this well known, and within a couple hours they fixed the problem. But during that little window, those systems that updated to 4.9.3 won't be able to update to 4.9.4 and anything moving forward. So I would just say to our listeners, check to make sure that you don't have 4.9.3. If you do, you should now just go to you can go to the dashboard under updates and then click update now, and your system will then jump to 4.9.4.
And as long as we mentioning that they're a sponsor, just for those of you listening, if you are a customer of WordPress.com, who's our sponsor, they do all of that automatically. That's been done. You don't have to worry about it. This is only for people who run self-hosted WordPress.
Right. Good. I got a note from a frequent tweeter and a friend of the show, Simon Zarafa, who saw somebody else's tweet and sent it to me as Murphy's Law as applied to software design and programming. Someone named Bruce Dawson tweeted that sort of the software programmer's spin, any mistake that is not explicitly prevented will be made. Any error that can occur will, which of course is everything we've learned on this podcast about the way security happens follows that. And Leo, now is the time for the college humor video about passwords.
I'm glad you mentioned this is safe for work, right?
Yes, it is safe for work.
Okay.
100%. And it's just very clever. I just love the idea that this is being done sort of as a public service.
And by the way, it's on Facebook, and I want to mention that the College Humor had to fire people because they're relying on Facebook for their traffic. And they don't get a whole lot of traffic from Facebook, so or they don't get to monetize it, I guess. So here you go on Facebook, College Humor, how to keep your passwords safe.
You know what they say, more money, more passwords, to protect that money from hackers, because there's more of them too. More money, more potential problems, but more passwords, no hackers. MC Safe Search. Online, I'm shopping and I'm feeling fine, but I gotta use some passwords to keep what's mine. Passwords are codes that protect your stuff. You gotta keep them all a secret to stay safe enough. But then how do you remember? It's the question that I get. I say, why not use the first name of your favorite pet? Mine's my dog, Mr. Noodles. It don't matter if you know, cause I was tricky and replaced some vowels with zeros. I mean, you know what? Never mind. That was a general example, not specifically mine. Oh man, give me 2 quick seconds. I mean, I'm not worried, dog, cause I'm password.
password protected.
Keep your words, keep your passwords tight. If you keep your words a secret, it'll be all right.
It's actually hysterical. If you're not seeing the video, it's
great. Don't say it to a parrot, they're the talkiest bird. You gotta go with a phrase that no one knows. Don't ever write it down, don't let it show. Don't you ever let it slip in front of a hacker. Gotta be extra careful with your secret passwords.
There we go. My account's all safe and sound. And get, yo, what do you think you're doing creeping, peeking around? Did that video just show what I just typed in? I just changed my log. Again, I gotta do it again. Now it's telling me I can't change again that quick. When I was typing, I really hope you did not film it. Dang, just got an alert that my account got hacked, but they don't have my social number, so I can just relax. Why would you show this, man? What a terrible choice. I said they do not have my number. Please listen to my voice.
Oh, cool. That was another message about my account from my bank saying I just bought a speedboat, so that's cool. Thanks. And a car and a fur coat and yet another boat. These hackers are the worst. They really get my goat.
Was trying to spread the word about keeping passwords safe, but this whole song is blown up in my face.
It's his piano player.
Keep your words, keep your passwords tight. If you slip up, you probably get hacked tonight. Then someone will use your cash to buy a coat or a boat or a car or another boat. You can't be too careful with your info. Don't ever let it slip. Don't let nobody know. You never know who's watching when you show your hands. Sometimes stealing someone's stuff. Is there hell?
Did you get that coat? Did I just get my identity stolen by my backup singer?
My man got hacked. Ha ha!
Dang, I've known you since the fourth grade, Bobby. I even share my pizza bagels with you.
Aww. That's good. College humor.
So the word is getting around.
Yeah, that's good.
How to make your password safe. Now, okay, this is bizarre, but I thought it was sort of fun. The tweet came in, and those of us who have been watching or have watched some of the series that we talked about a couple of weeks ago, Altered Carbon, will realize that this someone was having fun mixing Spinrite with some of the terminology from Altered Carbon. This person tweeted, "Dear Steve, I have a question regarding Spinrite. I've come across an old stack of my great-great-great-great, possibly more, grandmother. When trying to spin her up in VR, she loads for a very long time but eventually fails. There is also no luck when putting her in a new sleeve. What level would you recommend running Spinrite at to try and recover a failing stack? Thanks for everything,
love
Mitch."
It. Love it, love it, love it, love
so,
it.
So, yeah, it. I got a kick out of that. So, they
did you watch most, any more of Altered Carbon or just that first couple episodes?
I didn't.
So you missed the. Did you see the episode where she spins her grandma up, her abuela up into this tattooed Nazi skinhead?
No.
Oh, so that now is hysterical.
Now I understand what he's talking about.
Yes.
An old, old.
Apparently, every year
of,
on the Dia de las Muertas, she spins up grandma into whatever they call the body sleeves that are lying around at the jail where she works. And so she spins it up. But the funny thing is, this guy's got a role in the show. Later in the show, he turns back into the Nazi skinhead. So it's actually quite amazing. Yeah.
Yeah. So you are moving through the series?
Yeah, you know, I like it.
Good.
I enjoy it. It's a very adult, we should mention. Very violent, also sexy. It's beautiful. I thought it was beautiful. So, yeah. Did you get your HDR TV yet?
No, I didn't do that yet.
Can I get out there and do it?
I'll wait until I get amazing, vivid colors.
That's it. It's so much better.
So, Tom Terrific asked, if I change my local computer's DNS to 9.9.9.9 or 9.9.9.9, and my router has a different DNS lookup address, which has precedence? So that's a great question. Normally, the way all of our contemporary internet-connected computers are designed, whether Windows or Mac or Linux, is they use DHCP, Dynamic Host Configuration Protocol, to obtain all of those IP-related things from the network. So at startup, a query is sent out because the computer has no idea what network it's on. So it's just it's a non-specific broadcast saying, "Hey, is there a DHCP server here?" And then your DHCP server, typically your router, will speak up and say, "Yeah, we got DHCP services. What do you need?" And so then the client asks for IP address and DNS, and those things get sent. And also sometimes time of day and other stuff. So it's actually sort of a general purpose. DHCP can provide all kinds of information. But that's configurable. I'm sure that certainly Windows users have seen that obtain IP address automatically, and the same is true for DNS. You're able to obtain the DNS from automatically from your DHCP server. So the point is you are able to override that on your computer to say, no, I don't want it automatic. I'm going to specify the one or two, typically two DHCP DNS servers myself. So the answer is, if you deliberately override your computer's default setting, which is to obtain it automatically, then it will use what you tell it to, Tom. It will not use whatever the router's DNS is. It's offering it, but the computers essentially have to ask for it when they start up. And if you tell them, "Nope, I want to provide my own DNS," then that's what gets used. A question from Skynet asks, does Inspector, GRC's little program for monitoring the Meltdown and Inspector vulnerabilities that we talked about a couple weeks ago, run in boot camp? He says, can it see the chip, or should I run it in Wine on the Mac side? And the answer is yes. Boot camp is just an alternative boot for real Windows. I was making the distinction with a VM. Boot camp is not a virtual machine environment, neither is Wine. So either booting Windows on a Mac with boot camp or running it under Wine will allow it to see the chip, and you'll be able to determine whether the actual microcode has been updated in your processor and what vulnerabilities it may have. But only not if you're actually in a VM. And then we had the 1, 2, 3, 4, 5 different people with a little bit of overlap suggesting various ways of combining Spectre and Meltdown. David Lemire, he said, how about he was suggesting Spec Drown, since we have an endless stream of news about them, Spec Drown. Kyle at Craig Consulting said he proposes Smectre, S-M-E-C-T-R-E, Smectre.
No, that
didn't work. We have Joe McDaniel and Kevin both had, how about Smelter? So it's like, okay. Yeah. Smelter's not bad. And then Marco, of course, said, how about just combining Spectre and Meltdown as S&M? And it's like, okay. Yeah, it's not bad, S&M. Yeah. I was thinking maybe SAM, S-A-M, Spectre and Meltdown. So just referring to a SAM. But unfortunately, those are just so different from each other that it's not, none of those has really grabbed us so far. But thank you for your submissions. And Leo, let's take our final break, and then we're going to share the cryptocurrency antics which have surfaced in the last week.
Before we do, I do want to mention our alternate picture of the week. Ludwig Tramick, who is well known to us. He used to do the GizWiz, like he would do all the show notes. He did this website for us. He's a really great guy out of Poland. And let me see if I can find his email and read it to you, because it was we mentioned last week that I saw this thing and I was going to send it to you.
Yep.
Of a new dating site for people who have the same password. Yeah. Which really, you know, actually, if you think about it, it's good. So he says, hi, Leo, this is Ludwig. I'm not sure if you remember, but I used to write letters to the GizWiz podcast often. And oh, yeah, he created GizWizSearch.com. I don't know if that's still up. Today I was listening to Security Now just like every week and became shocked after you casually mentioned a website created by my coworker, quote, a new dating club of people who share the same password. The website just began as a joke in our office here in Warsaw, but then he went ahead and actually implemented it. He's the security expert at the company and does a lot of pen testing, so he knows his stuff. You couldn't remember the name. You said you wanted to find the website again. It is Words of Heart, HEART.com. Find and date people who have the same password. We believe that something as intimate as your password best describes your inner self. You can log in and give your password. I'm not sure you should. You can register and a photo required. I guess I don't know how far that down, how deep this goes, but it does say do not use your real password here, especially a password something important.
Right.
So maybe right. Maybe he's actually doing it. I don't know.
Well, and of course, our quick-witted listeners responded to last week's banter about this, Leo, saying, wait a minute. If they're not hashing the passwords, then they wouldn't know that they're the same.
It's please.
Well, actually, if they're exactly identical, then they would give out they would come to the same hash. Yeah. If you change capitalization or add some punctuation, that would obliterate it. But as long as there's an exact match, and after all, aren't we all looking for an exact match?
Ludwig also writes, which I love, thank you for teaching me English. Truly, when I started listening to Twit 12 years ago, I understood almost nothing. I learned English from your various shows. Now I'm pursuing an online master's in machine learning from Georgia Tech. So you changed my life.
Nice.
That's a nice story. Our show today brought to you by ZipRecruiter. If you're hiring, if you're the hiring manager, if you're the boss, if you're the person who does the hiring, you've got the most important job in the business. You're building the company piece by piece. Every employee that you put in there can build it to a bigger and better company, or every bad employee can tear the whole thing down. So that's why you really want to do a good job. And we've got a tool that will help you. Simple tools, powerful matching technology. It's the best way, the smartest way to find candidates for you. ZipRecruiter. We talked a lot about how you post on ZipRecruiter. It goes to 100-plus job sites. You know, you great, including Twitter and, you know, all the social networks. And it has a great tool for screening candidates, ranking them, and hiring the right one fast. But what we don't talk enough about is the intelligence in ZipRecruiter. When ZipRecruiter gets that job posting, they learn what you're looking for. They then go and identify the right people and invite them to apply to your job. So this is revolutionary in terms of how you find your next hire. 80% of the employers who post a job on ZipRecruiter, 80% find a quality candidate through the site in as little as one day. One day. So imagine somebody quits today and by tomorrow you've got their replacement and it's a better person. How about that? ZipRecruiter doesn't stop there. They even spotlight the strongest applications you receive so you can't accidentally miss a great match. Look, the right candidates are out there, okay? We're going to stipulate that somewhere out there is the perfect person for that opening you've got. ZipRecruiter is how you find them. Businesses of all sizes trust ZipRecruiter for their hiring needs. We've used them. Some of the biggest companies in the world have, too. And right now, you can try ZipRecruiter for free. That's right, free. Just go to ZipRecruiter.com/securitynow. ZipRecruiter.com/securitynow. Now, ZipRecruiter.com/securitynow. ZipRecruiter, the smartest way to hire.
I was reminded of that famous quote from bank robber Willie Sutton, who was asked about his chosen career.
Willie, why do you rob banks, Willie?
Exactly. And he said, I rob banks because that's where the money is.
Oh.
And what we're seeing is so many weird things happening around cryptocurrency because, you know, after it happened and as soon as it goes from being cyber to there being exchanges, which allow you to turn this synthetic made from thin air, well – are actually made from a lot of power these days, turn them into actual dollars that you can, you know, buy food with and use to keep a roof over your head and so forth. Suddenly, it becomes a thing. So, one thing that we saw in the last week was another worrisome way of getting cryptocurrency mining into unwitting browsers. We've talked about how malicious ads are running mining software on people's machines. It turns out that over the weekend, approximately 4,300 websites, many high profile, such as, get this, CUNY.edu.
Jeff Jarvis's site.
Yes. USCourts.gov, CookCountyTreasurer.gov. All visitors to those sites were mining the Monero cryptocurrency. On behalf of someone. How did this happen? Well, all of those sites support a plugin or a browser enhancement. Actually, it's not a plugin. It's JavaScript called Browse Aloud, which is a web screen reading service. So, and naturally, many governments have a requirement for assistive technology in order to help, for example, visually impaired visitors, so that there is a screen reading thing they have built in. So those sites had on their pages the invocation of this browsealoud.com script, ba.js. Well, what happened was the BrowseAloud server was compromised such that a document.write was inserted into the BrowseAloud JavaScript, which wrote an invocation for the CoinHive Monero cryptocurrency mining script into the pages. As a consequence, sort of through this second level indirection, all of the sites, and there are more than 4,300 of them. In fact, Leo, in the show notes here under public www.com, it's a search engine that allows you to find instances of scripts. And it shows it's how I saw that CUNY.edu was on the list. It shows 4,300 sites which are known to be hosting this browsealoud.js or ba.js script. And so all of those sites were inadvertently invoking the CoinHive Monero cryptocurrency miner. So, and as we know, and as I've said, it's not technically a massive security problem. It pulls some processing power from your system. People have objected to it being done behind their backs. But what it really does is it the fact that this could happen highlights a problem that we're sort of not paying enough attention to. And that is, and we've talked about it here before, that blindly importing the contents of third-party scripting libraries is inherently dangerous. That is, you know, those 4,300 sites intended to only be offering the Browse Aloud service, instead, for this period of time until the Browse Aloud folks were notified and they got their servers cleaned up, they were the inadvertent host of cryptocurrency mining. So, of course, our web browsers have dealt with the inherent danger represented by third-party scripting libraries by enforcing containment. And we've talked about how we use the browsers strongly enforce the so-called same origin policy, which creates script isolation to limit what a script can do and to what it can touch. But this happens to be sort of an interesting example of a script whose purpose is not to breach that containment, but it's quite happy to purr along running within its own container because its intent is to soak up as much of its hosting machine's spare CPU cycles as possible for annoyingly low-yield cryptocurrency mining. In other words, the thing that's sort of annoying is that JavaScript is just not a useful language for implementing cryptocurrency mining, but they're hoping to operate on the principle of, well, you know, if it's spread far and wide enough, you end up with enough aggregating hashing power to have it amount to something. And in fact, in some of the stories that we've been covering recently, we have seen, we talked about one last week where in that case, they were actually using Eternal Blue to infect Windows servers and mining on them. Well, that's much more high yield mining than using JavaScript. But they were generating thousands of dollars per something. Was it a day or a week? I don't remember. I think it was a week. So, you know, it does add up. In a somewhat different twist, another interesting bit is a website that is, and this is sort of what we were talking about, probably going to happen in the future. Salon.com is now formally offering visitors who are using ad blockers the option of mining Monero while they're on Salon's website. And Leo, and I went there myself, and sure enough, because I'm using uBlock Origin, I got the blocker. I got the notice. If you just go to salon.com, it'll come right up.
So they're doing it without telling you?
Well, unfortunately, yes. You get a blocker, but if you click on tell me more, then while they're telling so there you're seeing the page that I saw this morning. If you click on tell me more, then they try to be mining cryptocurrency while you're reading that message.
Oh, yeah. It says block ads by allowing Salon to use your unused computing power.
Yep.
Which, of course, means and then they have a fairly long
thing.
I don't know if they talk really about the Monero part of it. But
yeah, they don't go in any detail. And yeah. and it's funny, too. They spin it as a, you know, the advertising-based model is beginning to collapse, and we're excited about the blockchain, and we want to be participating in the future, and blah, blah, blah. So it's sort of a way of saying, you know, if you can either bring your ad blocker down, or we're going to run cryptocurrency mining in the background. Now, it didn't work for me. I thought, oh, cool, because I wanted to verify.
It just darkened my screen. I don't know if that's uBlock Origin doing it or...
No, that wouldn't be uBlock Origin. That's probably them saying, you know, we're still not happy with you.
Yeah.
because what happened was the reporting said that they start mining the moment you say, tell me more, rather than an opt-in, giving them opt-in permission. So I thought, okay, I want to verify that by seeing my CPU get pinned. Unfortunately, uBlock Origin also blocks CoinHive, and they're just using CoinHive. So one of the things, I mean, and as I have said here on the podcast, I don't think this is such a bad idea. That is, I mean, users need to be informed. But, for example, I am constantly annoyed by, is it the New York Times? I think it's the New York Times. It has a very strong paywall. Sometimes I'm interested in stories that are there, but I don't want to subscribe. But on the other hand, I wouldn't mind if they pinned my CPU while for the duration of time that I'm looking at a story on the New York Times. If they want to do that with permission, saying, okay, you know, you're not a subscriber, can we use your processor while you're here? I'd say, yeah, fine. And so, I mean, it's an interesting sort of micropayment scheme. It's annoying that JavaScript is so inefficient because it means that the economics won't really work until we come up with browser-integrated cryptocurrency mining. But I think it's a valid model. I don't want ads that are annoying, but if I could pay by using a little bit of processing power while I'm somewhere, and if it's efficient, so it's JavaScript isn't, but if our web browsers had true GPU accelerated mining built in, the economic model might work. And I think it's kind of an interesting model. Anyway, Solon is giving it a try. And so it'll be interesting to see how that works for them. And again, in this sort of following the notion that the lure of actual exchangeable for real currency, cryptocurrency, creates pressure. You know, we've talked about how security is probably impossible to make perfect. You know, certainly, you know, Apple's security surrounding their source code is going to be incredibly good. Yet, despite that, where there was pressure from this intern's friends who kept bugging him or her to please, 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 please give us the iBoot source. We promise, we promise, we promise. We'll never let it go. We'll never, you know, blah, blah, blah. Finally, the person was convinced to do so. So it was pressure which created the problem. Well, cryptocurrency creates pressure. And so we now have the first known instance of a water purification plant's network, that is it's SCADA, you know, SCADA is the acronym for supervisory control and data acquisition. It was the SCADA network running the centrifuges in Iran, which was breached and allowed them to get messed up. So these SCADA networks are notoriously insecure. They're the kinds of things which you really don't want to have on the internet. You need them on the intranet because their nature is to allow you to do process control, monitoring, and so forth, much as you would have in a big water purification plant. Unfortunately, it's convenient for them to be on the internet. So, of course, that's where they end up being. And in this case, a cybersecurity company who specializes in this sort of critical infrastructure, a company named Rataflow, announced that they had found for them, it's the first time it's been in the news, an instance of cryptocurrency mining, again, Monero cryptocurrency, being done on the servers within the network of this company as a consequence of their SCADA network being compromised. So, yes, cryptocurrency also being mined in the water purification plants. And finally, and this one pretty much I wanted to wrap up with this one because it's one for the ages. Russian nuclear scientists have been arrested for logging into one of Russia's most secure supercomputers to mine Bitcoin. Several scientists working at a nuclear weapons facility in Russia were arrested on the suspicion that they used one of Russia's most powerful supercomputers, to which they had access for nuclear science research, to mine bitcoins. This apparently took place at the Federal Nuclear Center in Sarov, which is a top secret area surrounded, you know, in Russia by barbed wire fences where the Soviet Union's first nuclear bomb was produced during the Cold War. According to reporting by the BBC and the Interfax News Agency, they wrote, quote, "There has been an unsanctioned attempt to use computer facilities for private purposes, including so-called mining. As far as we're aware, a criminal case has been launched against the believed perpetrators." So, yes, once again, as Willie Sutton said, I rob banks because that's where the money is. If there's a supercomputer that is not being used completely, well, why not run a little Bitcoin mining operation on it and generate some Bitcoins while you're at it? Except that that was unsanctioned.
Did you see that China is now shutting down its Bitcoin miners? So they're all moving to Iceland, where because of geothermal and hydroelectric power, it's very cheap. So Iceland may become the new miner central.
Yep. And in fact, there was another story last week. There's the state of Washington, some county or region in the state of Washington is being turned upside down because their power is 3 to 4 cents per something, megawatt or kilowatt, or I don't remember what the units were, but it was like way inexpensive. And so major mining operations are coming in and asking for 200 megawatt connections. The problem is that requires them to build out a much larger infrastructure, which they would like to do. I mean, they would like to satisfy demand, but if mining then collapses and all of this business dries up, they're stuck with infrastructure that had a 30, 40 year expected amortization life and no one who needs it and is willing to continue paying for it.
Yeah.
So it's causing all kinds of problems.
Wow.
And it's like, oh, cryptocurrency mining. Yep.
Oh, boy. They requested – there apparently a bunch of warehouses on the waterfront. The requested amount of power, I think it was 100 – maybe it's 1,000 megawatts, exceeds the entire usage of all of Iceland.
Wow.
I think Iceland uses 340 megawatt hours, and they're asking for 1,000.
Yeah, you got to be careful about melting ice up there, too, because that generates a lot of heat.
That's a lot of heat. It's amazing. Steve, as always, so much fun, so interesting and informative. Always a pleasure. I know we were talking before the show. You've got three more things to do on Squirrel.
Squirrel is I plan to have an announcement next week.
Nice.
We're very close. I thought I had two things left to do, and someone said, "Hey, I thought you were going to deal with high DPI awareness." It's like, oh, that's right. I forgot about that, because with screens getting higher resolution, my UI normally is just like the standard useful size for standard resolution monitors.
It would be this size, in fact, on a DPI monitor.
It is very small.
Postage stamp.
Yeah. But remember that from the very beginning, I built Squirrel to be language independent.
Right.
Every single – there's no text, no English in the app at all. It all exists in an external file, which – and remember there was a crowdsource – no, and not – it was not – it was – crowd, I can't remember what it's called. I think if you go to squirrel.grc.com, I think that was an alias to the service that provides translation. We were going to crowdsource various translations of it. Anyway, the point is I built that in from the beginning, and because different languages have different requirements for linear length of their text, I built in a scalable UI facility from the start. So in theory, I should be able – if I see that somebody's got their fonts scaled to 150%, which is the way Windows handles high DPI screens, I ought to be able to just say, oh, and drop that single number in at one point in the code, and it will scale the entire UI. I've never done that before, you know, but it's built in. So even if it doesn't work at first, it ought to work pretty quickly. But anyway, we're down to very few things remaining to be done. I will then spend a little bit of time on the demo website. I do need to bring up web forums, because all of the people who want me to get back to work on SpinRite don't want me to be spending all of my time redundantly answering questions about Squirrel. So my plan is to bring up some web forums where all of the people who have been working with me over in GRC's kind of semi-private old school text-only NNTP news groups, they'll be able to and are interested in helping people to understand what Squirrel is. We've got Android developers, native Mac developers, an iOS. It's running for iOS. Mine runs under Windows and Wine, so it can run under Mac and Linux. And, you know, so things are happening. And so, of course, my intention is to get it launched, and then I will turn my attention to the GRC's web pages to bring its description up to speed, because I haven't looked at it for years, and I need to make that current. And then back to SpinRite 6.
Good.
And happily, and not a minute too soon.
Nice.
And happily so.
Yay.
And I'm going to come up, and we will do a Squirrel announce and presentation in the Twit Studios.
Nice. I look forward to
thanks,
that.
Thanks That'll to be your being willingness to host that. That'll be great.
Yeah. That'll be great. Wow. Well, if you listen to this show and you enjoy it, there's a couple of things I should tell you about. First of all, you can always watch it live or listen to it live or join us live in studio, which is always nice. We have our friend from Des Moines visiting. It's so nice to have, let me get your name right here, Adam, visiting from Des Moines. All you have to do is email us, let us know you're coming. Tickets at twit.tv. You can also listen and watch live on the stream. We have audio and video streams at twit.tv/live. If you do that, by all means, check out the chat room, irc.twit.tv. People really have a good time during the show in there trying to parse everything we talk about. It's kind of fun. You can also get on-demand versions. Steve has audio at grc.com. He also has transcripts. It's the only place you can get nicely written transcripts by Steve commissions them from Elaine Ferris. It's very nice. So you can search. You can use that to search. You can also use it to just read along as you listen. grc.com. While you're there, check out SpinRite. This is Steve's only source of income. This is bread and butter. Make some yabba-dabba-doos happen in the studio during the show. Get a copy of the world's best hard drive maintenance and recovery utility. You can even work it on your sleeve. You know, get your, what do they call that token that's got your personality in it? Get that all.
Bring granny back. It's called a stack.
Get your stack all. Bring granny back. That's your new slogan.
Get your stack
slogan.
Back.
Get your stack
back. Get your
back.
Stack back. Yep.
GRC.com. If you want to see video or you or have other interests, you want to see more, you can always go to our website, twit.tv. The show is at twit.tv/SN. We also have links to all of the different podcatchers, so you can subscribe and make sure you get every episode, audio or video. You want to keep them all for future reference. Next week, Steve, thanks for being here. We'll see you next time on Security Now.
Thanks, buddy.
Bye, Mom. Security.